Namo Myoho Renge Kyo, thank you for being here. Welcome, if this is your first video or podcast. I wanted to talk today as kind of an information and maybe a reminder that on the website, threefoldlotus.com, I have a lot of information from every period of Shakyamuni's teaching, because these are all questions that come up, even though our practice is complete in practicing Myoho Renge Kyo, and that the Lotus Sutra is the ultimate of all Shakyamuni's teachings. His basically the complete teaching that we practice through Myoho Renge Kyo is all of Shakyamuni's teaching. But for me, there was always a rub there that in the Lotus Sutra, we just casually, or even in the Gosho, especially if you read the Gosho or listen to the podcasts on Nichiren's Goshos, and the Lotus Lectures, there's constantly these terminologies that creep up, pop up in mid-sentence, and we just go right by them, right? Like two of them I can think of are the three marks of existence or the five precepts. And we, well, what are those? Tell me what those are. So there's a lot of assumed knowledge and experience. By the time you read the Lotus Sutra, Shakyamuni taught this at the last 8 years of his life, and it didn't get distributed into text and written text until long after his passing. So everyone was accustomed to these earlier teachings, and when it finally came around and started making its rounds and going from India to China and so forth, people had already been educated on a lot of these concepts and so forth. And so they just took it as read. But you and I didn't necessarily get that exposure, right? And there's a lot of groups out there, whether they're sectarian, Nichiren, sects that want to claim they're the right one, or groups, secular groups that just worry about their organization, and then you come somewhere down the line under the balance sheet. They all have their own motives to keep you controlled, right? That's the nature of authoritarianship. And it's rampant. It's everywhere now. And I'm a big proponent, as you should know by now, of breaking those invisible barriers for us, because we're practicing the practice ascribed, described, taught by Shakyamuni Buddha. Not by some guy in a tower, some politician, some head monk today who thinks he's the new incarnation of Nichiren, screw that. We're practicing directly. We're using Nichiren scholarship, not your organization's scholarship, and we're practicing Shakyamuni's Buddhism, period. Not all this other junk, right? So we're going to do what Shakyamuni taught us to do. And Nichiren backed it up as well. Study all of Buddhist scholarship. But when you study all of Buddhist scholarship, it's kind of like studying all of the same exhortation if you want to learn just about anything today, right? In the old days, you were an apprentice and you slowly got to learn from a master of whatever it is you're learning, whether it's painting, sculpting, mathematics, English, writing, so on and so forth, shoe cobbling. You started by being an apprentice so you could be not only learn basics, but build on those basics so that when you did something more complex, you understood all of what it went into doing it this particular way with this particular material for these particular reasons, right? You don't just jump in face first to learn how to dive off the high board without knowing that the pool has to have frickin' water in it. Okay? There's a lot of assumed knowledge, right? So that doesn't mean, though, that by filling the pool with water, you suddenly know how to drive off a 15-meter platform, does it? So we learn not only in steps and degrees, but we also learn the proper order of things. And we learn as we get more sophisticated, and this is life as well, right? What I knew at 15 years of age was a lot of data. But a lot of it didn't really get sorted out and take its proper place until I was in my 20s and even later. That's just the nature of how our minds function in samsara, right? So just because we read some early teaching about, 500 rules for this and 250 ways of behaving and the 8 noble truths and the 4 noble truths and the precepts and all this stuff doesn't mean suddenly, oh, that's how we practice. Relax. Okay. That is understanding fundamental ways of thought, because Buddhism is about the mind. How do we think? Why or what is it that creates our understanding of this life that we're living, right? Like I say all the time, it's energy in momentum. It's like kinetic energy, right? Our lives is just, we're moving through it. Whether you want to or not, you're moving through it. You're not static. Nothing is static. And that's one of the early points of Buddhism, right? Nothing exists in and of itself. Things exist moment to moment. There's a trajectory, and we can influence that trajectory. But until you understand that your thoughts, your actions, your body, your mind is a time-based thing, that it's not a solid thing, that it's constantly changing in flux. The word that's often translated from the early text is impermanence, impermanent. That's what that means. It's not permanent. In other words, it only exists moment to moment. And the only thing that realizes that it exists moment to moment is your mind. You can, well, it's a microscope. Well, it's a TV. Well, it's a... Those are just ways of seeing and measurement. What's at play here is the mind. The mind is everything in Buddhism. Okay? And as an example of all of this, on threefoldlotus.com, if you go to the core study materials page, you'll have links that'll open up documents. Like there's 2 here I'm going to review today. One's called the 3 marks of existence. What the heck is that? Click on it. Oh, one's called the 5 precepts. There's 250. There's 500. There's three. There's two. There's numbers all over Buddhism, right? But here's the idea. Five precepts, you'll get the idea. All right? The three marks of existence is just another label for, and Buddhism does this a lot. If you bother to read like several sutras from provisional Mahayana or Hinayana to a later Mahayana, certainly the Lotus Sutra, as your understanding of these terminologies grow, you will start to understand that there are a lot of terms used throughout the teachings that are kind of different names for the same things, because Shakyamuni reintroduced concepts at different points of understanding so that there would be a different depth of understanding because of the capacity of the people he was talking to. Okay, so the three marks of existence, that sounds like a whole new thing, but guess what they are? And so this is a document. You can print it out. It's two pages, and it's linked on the course study materials. What are the three marks of existence? Impermanence, not self, and suffering. So it's a little bit deeper dive into the Four Noble Truths, isn't it? It's the same thing. But just knowing that, when you come across and you're reading some chapter in the Lotus Sutra or the Gosho, and suddenly in the sentence, just as we're going here through three marks of existence, you go, what? What's that? Because you're not familiar with the term. Now you're familiar. It's a simple thing. You can relate it to the Noble Truths. You can relate it to the skandhas. You can relate it to all these other terms. It's kind of demystifying, right? That's the benefit of study. Because you don't just take as read, oh, it means this. You have all these terms floating in your head, right? Understanding, and Buddhism is great at this, the minutia, the digging in of these different things, demystifies it. It makes it so that you can relate Buddhist teachings to your own experience. Even if you read not self, sometimes this is called egolessness. But actually, there's more to it than ego. The Buddhist teaching of not self asks us to explore the reality of objects in ourselves in depth like no other teaching. Nothing that exists, including you, exists in and of itself without dependencies. So just reading that, I haven't read the whole thing, obviously, but let's talk about that. What do you mean by dependencies? We know that word, but in Buddhism, I don't exist without dependencies. What is that? Well, it's super simple, right? It's like I hear this glass half empty, glass half full. You've heard that a million times, right? Well, consider this. I'm going to play Buddhist interrogator here. Okay, the glass is half empty or half full. What if you hold the glass in an aquarium full of water? Is the glass half empty or half full? Here's the more profound question. Is there a glass? Assuming this is a perfect glass of transparent glass, is there a glass? Does there exist a glass in the aquarium full of water? Your eyes might trick you on that, right? You're holding a glass, you know there's a glass in there. But if you look and try to decide, is there a glass in the water, you might be confused. So let's dig a little deeper. Does the glass exist because the water exists? Or does the water exist because the glass exists? Okay, screw the water. Take the glass out of the water. The glass is a reference of something we call a container, but it is contained in the air around us and in our hands, but that's just supported. That's not contained. What I'm saying is the existence of the glass, whatever shape it has, whether it has an inside or outside, the glass doesn't just appear in the middle of nothingness and suddenly there's something called glass. The glass appears through a process of accumulation of some other material, right? It's made, it's formed, and then ultimately, the only reason we call it a glass is in the word glass, we infer, well, actually we don't. Glass is also a window, isn't it? That doesn't hold anything, liquid, matter, anything, right? But certainly a glass that you, a drinking glass, let's say drinking glass. Now we've added another word so we can start to parameterize what we're talking about. And this drinking glass is a vessel, a container for us. And now with our minds, we're preoccupied as to whether or not it contains anything, and further, how much it contains. But it always contains. A drinking glass always contains air. It's always full. Because that's the nature of a drinking glass. You see, we can keep going with this. We can play Nagarjuna. And we can prove and disprove the existence of this glass. Why? This drinking glass. Why? In fact, turn that drinking glass over and it's still full. Right? It's never empty. Because there's no such thing as a perfect vacuum. And even if there were, it would still contain the vacuum. It is a container. It's what it does. Or doesn't. These are provisional terms, nama rupa, name and form, that you and I have agreed conceptually for this. It's a product of mind. And just like that drinking glass, so are trees, you, me, this computer, right? So how far do you want to dissect something? How far do you need to? But understanding that that's one of the marks of existence. Now the term marks of existence isn't so much about whacking something and making a mark. It is a characteristic, a mark of something that's black is that it absorbs light and gets hot from the radiation of the sun. A mark of something that's white reflects more light, stays cooler than the black in the same situation. These are marks of existence. One existence starts to be less about this and more about conception, perception, right? Buddhism is about the mind. Never forget. The five precepts. Oh boy, precepts. Those are like laws, right? The first... that's interesting. The five precepts are not an absolute, rigid set of rules, but provide a practical basis for good, ethical living, which will produce the right environment in which to seek out our own truths, Well, doesn't that statement mirror everything I'm constantly saying to you? The five precepts, they're not laws, they're not rules, they're not absolute. If you're going to be a monk, you have to observe these precepts. It's not about following rules. It's about having thought tools to consider how you and I are living, how we're perceiving, how we're moving through this life. How are you driving your life? Or are you just waiting for things to happen? Here are some tools to help you see what you're doing. Observe your own mind. First precept, don't intentionally kill living beings. You won't burn in hell if you kill a human being, but you will cause yourself great, great anguish, let alone the living thing you killed is dead. You've taken, the thing in Buddhism is by killing a sentient being is permanently ending their potential for enlightenment. That's the offense. Ending a life is ending a process of self-enlightenment. That is why it's such a severe prohibition. There are other ways to stop a living being's process toward enlightenment that involve manipulation, brainwashing. I mean, you sit for a while, you'll come up with a few. But killing, there's no coming back from that. Right? We step on ants every day. And this isn't really with any lack of care. And I doubt if it's possible to avoid occasionally beating the odd cockroach to oblivion. However, the premeditated killing of other human and senseless killing of animals for sport certainly is not desirable for Buddhists. The primary goal of this precept is to develop concern for the safety and welfare of others and to have compassion for all living things. Because every one of us is in a different state of mind, life condition, tendencies. Some of us at some times are completely controlled by emotion. Men and women, hormones do this to us. Hormones are causations. They're part of our karma, the energy that is moving along. And each of us has our own chemistry, biology, mind sets. And that's why Buddhism is extremely personal. The way you change your behavior may have some commonality with others, but it will be yours. That's why there's no book on how, like a recipe on how to be a Buddhist. This is why Myoho Rengekyo is the ultimate teachings of Shakyamuni. Because when you learn all of these ideas and then you coalesce them into one focused awakening of something you then understand as what an awakening is, that clear, unattached mind, you are actually kind of flushing out your karma. You're knocking it around and you're influencing it. You're changing the momentum. You're affecting the momentum. Not changing it, affecting it. Because the momentum is life. It never stops until life stops. The two are together. And kinetic energy is what drives all of this, your karma, right? So the second precept, don't take what hasn't been given. Sounds pretty straightforward. Don't steal. But it also means don't be manipulative. Don't try to trick people or take advantage of situations. You know when you're doing it. You know when you're doing it to yourself. How many times in your life have you felt really sad for whatever reason? Depression, a loved one died, a car accident, whatever. Think of anything that's brought you down. How many times have you taken that situation with yourself and said, I'm going to drink some alcohol because I'm depressed? Well, you're doing it. You're manipulating yourself and taking an opportunity of a bad situation, and you're making it worse. Tendencies and conditions. And we do this with others. And Buddha is saying, it's not a good way to live your life. What does this harken back to? The Eight Noble Truths. It's just a repetition of the same sorts of things. Called the Five Precepts. The third, sexual misconduct. Ooh, I got a bunch of people's attention with that one. But it's also not misusing the senses. You know, as the strongest drive after the survival instinct, directed wisely and skillfully, living to excess, and in particular, excessive eating, also causes grief. This precept encourages us to be content with more simple things. Boy, that's not what we're taught in our societies today. Greed, 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 greed. More, 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 more. Let me take my billions of dollars and instead of helping people and spreading it out and seeing all that joy, let me build my rocket ship so I can say I went to space. I pooped in a bag in zero gravity. Ha ha! What have you accomplished? I mean, that's Bezos, but you and I do the same thing, right? We take advantage of situations and we live to excess. I really like this all-you-can-eat buffet. I paid $9 for this. I'm going to get my money's worth. And so you pile on four meals and you eat them all. Ha ha ha, I got my value. And then you go home and you can't sleep and you throw up and come on. I'm not saying all heavyweight people are gluttons and pigs. I know thin people who can eat me under the table. I mean, overeat. But this precept's about sexual misconduct. Does every opportunity we have for sex mean that we have to have sex? Can we be dignified about it? Can we honor people's bodies, our own bodies? Can we turn sex into a privilege and a wonder and a mechanism for accomplishing something other than just momentary satisfaction and walk away from it? So what is this? This precept is really about ethics. How do we behave with other people? With ourselves? How do we control our urges, our earthly desires? Right? Nietzsche said, go ahead, go to bed with your wife and have sex with her. And while you're having sex, look into each other's eyes and chant, Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. If you can do that, it's going to change your sex act into something well, other, right? It's not easy to do. I've tried it. The fourth precept, we're encouraged not to speak falsely, not to lie, slander, misrepresent, or gossip maliciously. Yikes, that's a biggie, right? How often do we do that? We don't even know we're doing it. But the point, again, isn't that if you say something bad about somebody, you should go and flagellate yourself. This teaches us to speak truthfully, again, the lie thing, and kindly, and to have positive motives when we approach a discussion. That part's very important to me, because I'm one of those people, like I've said before, I'm the kid in the audience who goes, "The emperor's naked." It's not very nice. It's not very gentle. Doesn't sound very nurturing. But my motives are, you people are being confused and you're confusing yourselves, and this just isn't true. Look at the truth. Come on. Right? That's my motive. That's my intent. So don't be too down on yourselves when you're critical of something. Just be certain that when you're critical of something, your motive is correction, to betterment, to be a good helper. Don't just crap all over something because you think it's not good. Before you start criticizing something, have in your mind a better path. Have in your mind, this could be so much better, or this is damaging, this is wrong, don't do this because this. Have the argument played out in your mind so that your motive is truly genuine and helpful. That kind of critique, that's important in life. Buddha is not saying don't critique things. He's just saying don't be malicious. Don't critique things just so you can go, "Ha, you idiot." Right? That's not helpful. And the fifth one, I know a lot of you might have a problem with, if you haven't had a problem so far. Intoxicants. Look, I'm 64. I'm taking a lot of drugs I wish I didn't have to take. I try to wean myself off of them. Everything from Tylenol to Lyrica to Tramadol. I have serious nerve damage and I have some problems that I have to live with, and so that I can have a productive life and do these videos, right? So I have to take them. And as I try to wean myself off of them, the pain becomes overwhelming. I can't function. I have to take those drugs. So the fifth precept understands this. Unnecessary drugs, though. Think I'll drop some ecstasy and see how that makes me feel? No. Think I'll drink half a bottle of vodka? No. Why? The reasoning is because anything that you put in your body that's an intoxicant, even cigarettes and coffee, they impair your mind. And what is Buddhism about? How can you practice awakening an excellent, clear mind if in your life you keep poisoning it? You're at odds with your enlightenment. Make that more important. Now, those five precepts aren't anything new to us, are they? Labeled as the five precepts. Okay. So now when you listen or read, Gosho or Lotus Sutra or any sutra, and you those terms pop up, oh yeah, that's conduct, that's behavior. And this is why we can say when we read the Lotus Sutra and we come across these different labels for things, because they're a shorthand to years of teaching, right? When we say in our society, this is just a matter of arithmetic, you know right away, plus, minus, add, subtract, divide, multiply. You know what arithmetic is. I don't have to explain to you every time I want to talk about adding and subtracting. Think about an accountant's conference. Oh my God. If they had to constantly, or oh my Buddha, whatever. You know, it's just a term, right? And I've watched this gal's, she's an astrophysicist, I think, cosmologist. She says, oh my universe. Makes me laugh. Oh my perception. That's more accurate, really. You know, if every time an arithmetic function came up in an accountant's conference, they had to go back and reinvestigate what the concept of numbers and addition and subtraction and the whole thing, fractions, they'd never leave that conference. They'd be there their whole life. We have to create containers. Back to containers. I don't know how I did that. Arithmetic is a container of a lot of other subject matter. The same is what we do in Buddhism. Make sense? So there's a lot of these very meticulous labels like the five precepts, or the three marks of existence, or the 3,000 realms in a single thought moment of life. The point isn't the numbers so much as it is the implication that there are more than the thing in front of our noses to think about when we're thinking, when we're experiencing. There are a lot of things at work. And we need to habituate ourselves to this kind of thinking. This is opening up Buddha wisdom, another label. The wisdom that comes from understanding, am I being malicious? Am I being nurturing? Am I true to this state that I want to achieve of clarity and wonderment in life? Am I living my fullest life? By doing this, am I supporting doing that fullest life? You know, Aristotle, let's jump out of Buddhism for a minute. His description of happiness, very Western word, happiness. What the hell is happiness? He said, the simple formula for happiness is set yourself a goal that's unachievable. Okay, being 24/7, 365, 6, whatever, leap year, all the time in my clear Buddha mind state. That's unachievable. I want to achieve it, but it's so far from my life experience that if I can achieve it in moments, I'm overjoyed and I learn more and more from it. But can I be in it all the time? That's my goal. That's my bodhisattva way, to live in the Buddha way, the Buddha mind. Maybe it's building the largest suspension bridge in the world, whatever. But as Buddhists, our goal is massive, right? And Aristotle said this is very simple. If every thought, word, or deed, every action you take in your life, from the moment you wake up to the moment you go to bed at night or sleep, everything you do is measured against and seen as working toward that goal, even if it's just copying certain parts of the Lotus Sutra or Nichiren's Gosho so you can share it with a friend or others. Any action you take, if you can honestly look at what you're doing and say, this helps to propel me toward that goal, then you're happy. That's happiness, according to Aristotle. It's not only working toward the goal that makes you happy, but listen to this. If you're doing something and you suddenly realize, this isn't supporting my goal. In fact, it may be not only stalling me, but sending me in another direction. It becomes very easy to say, no, I'm not doing that. And refocus yourself on actions that take you to your goal. It's much easier to make decisions in life. Is this decision, every time you make a decision, is this decision supporting my goal of Buddhahood? Is it? It's easy to decide. And Aristotle even gave you a way out. He said, look, if one day you have a major decision to make, and it's something that is critical that you absolutely see great value in doing, but it doesn't take you toward that goal, then it's time for you to sit down and really contemplate if you should change your goal. But I don't think, Aristotle's very pragmatic. So is Buddha. Shakyamuni, I should say. Siddhartha Gautama. But if you're going to change your goal, you better think long and hard about what it is you've been doing and where it is you're going. You can't just idly sit down and go, well, I want to do this, so I'll just change my goal. I won't work toward my Buddhahood today. I'll save that for tomorrow. Now you're doing, remember the precepts? You're manipulating yourself. So, what's this video about? What's this podcast about? It's about a lot of things. It's about taking yourself seriously. It's about happiness. It's about being your best possible self. It's about being really aware, really observing yourself in action, which in itself is not an easy thing because we're not trained to do that, are we? We're trained to come up with excuses. Oh, yeah, I did all that bad stuff and I hurt those people, but I was drunk. Who chose to be drunk? You can't just absolve all the pain and anguish you caused and guilt and stupidity because you chose to intoxicate yourself to the point where you were doing all kinds of horrible things. You didn't lose control. You just chose a really bad behavior, a really bad set of mental attitudes. And there are consequences. Nothing in this world, as far as a teaching goes, is more about personal responsibility than Buddhism. It's all on you, but all the rewards are yours. Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. I appreciate you guys listening to my little rant today. Part of it is because I want you to stay aware that I have a bunch of stuff like this online free. ThreefoldLotus.com. There's lots of stuff on there. There's even old stuff from when I used to teach martial arts. My martial arts teachings were very much focused on attitude and intent. There were two paths, essentially, in martial arts. In countries of origin, from India to China to Korea, Japan. And it's either challenging yourself physically until your understanding of the abilities of your physical self enlightened your mind, and a lot of people forget that, or you can control your body to do amazing things if you get your mind right. And that was the path I took. Mind over matter, mind over body, mind. So Buddhism was an immediate fit for me very early on. But this idea that martial arts is sport, that's not martial arts. That's just violence. And I can't support that. And I know I'm living in one of the most violent countries in the world. And I know there are worse governments out there that are inhuman as hell. But none of them have the trillions of dollars that we invest in regime change wars and military might and all of that. And I could go on and on. Just turn the TV on for 10 minutes, watch YouTube. You'll find violence everywhere. It's hard to find a movie to watch that isn't based on violence, revenge, whatever. Even a comedy. Yeah, that's the state of humanity today. So if you don't have something to chant about, there's always something to chant about. Because we're all a part of it. We tend to forget that when 700,000 Africans are slaughtered with machetes and thrown into rivers to poison the water supply, that's karma that we share. We may not be physically doing it, but we are participating by being here, being. That's the bodhisattva way, compassionate way. It's all on our shoulders to clean up our lives so that we affect our universe, our neighbors, our friends, our environment. Unless we just let it decay, just wait for things to blow up. It's not a way to live life fully, is it? So, Namo Myoho Renge Kyo, keep chanting. You guys are awesome. I so much appreciate you guys. Can't even express it. And I've been experimenting with words lately, like flabbergasted. And I heard one gobsmacked. I mean, we have lots of words to describe amazement and joy. But I'd like that to come from Myoho Renge Kyo. I want that Buddha mind that is constantly that amazed joy. Because to look at how everything functions in the universe, it's hard to contain, isn't it? And it is amazing. And to get out of our mud-soaked boots from the mud suction, pulling our boots off our feet, that is our attachments and our samsaric life, all we have to do is chant. It's not that hard. Namo Myoho Renge Kyo, right? All right. I'm going to thank you again because I can't thank you enough. Thank you for being here. Thank you for keeping me going and all your emails and your comments. I love every one of them. And I'll see you in the next one. Take care of your health, please. And be kind to yourself and others. Bye for now. Hey, thank you for being here. Did you know there's a third way you can help support this channel? And it won't cost you a cent. Yep, if you are not able to be a patron on Patreon or use the PayPal me at .com at Sifu Sylvain because you don't have the financial fortune to help support this channel right now, you, as I say, always support this channel by watching. But you can also help us grow so that maybe one day we can get over 10,000 subscribers and YouTube will grace us with monetization. It's not a lot, but if you can make sure you're subscribed and share a video, like a simple one, just go into the search criteria and type monk and you'll have a video that'll come up that's been up for years about what is a monk. You know, it's called monk, who, how, where, something like that. That might be a great introduction to somebody who doesn't understand what a monk is to begin with. It's a tool. Use this channel as a tool to help you with your bodhisattva practice and share a video to somebody who you think, oh, I know somebody who'll benefit from watching this. And in that way, you can help us grow. And that's a really good way to help your practice along as well. So just wanted to drop that in on you, in case that's something that you might find useful. Take care of yourself again, and I'll see you soon. Bye.